are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Butcher of Hanover focuses on the serial killer of at least 27 young men and boys in Germany in the post-World War I era. At the center of this murder case were Fritz Harman and Hans Granz, who were lovers while committing these murders. It wasn't until the skulls and bones start washing ashore from the Lien River in Hanover that Germany realized they had a cold-blooded serial killer in their country. As you read the exploration of this case in this book, ask yourself, did Harman murder each victim to keep his lover, Hans Granz, to stay with him? Did Granz decide who it was that was to be murdered? The evidence on this case will keep you on the edge of your seat trying to determine who was really behind these gruesome murders. The book we're featuring this evening is Butcher of Hanover, Fritz Harman, with my special guest, journalist, author, and host of House of Mystery, Alan R. Warren. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Alan R. Warren.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us once again. And again, you've picked an incredible subject to be able to write about in Butcher of Hanover. Let's talk about Fritz Harman. Right in the beginning, you say he was born in Hanover, Germany, October 25th, 1879, and his father was Ollie and his mother, Johanna. Tell us a little bit about his parents. He had five siblings. Tell us a little bit about his early life, what that was like in Hanover.
Well, his early life, he was the family was middle class. His father was a worker, and you know, they didn't have a whole lot of money, but they were comfortable. They were kind of a middle class, a little upper middle class. He was the sixth of the children, the last. And when it happened, his mother became a little bit ill, and she was having problems being mobile. So she was stuck to her bed a lot, more than normal. So she didn't get around too much. She had married Ollie, and Ollie was a younger guy and better looking, but he was young and sort of healthy, and she was a little bit older than him, like 7-8 years older. And
right.
So that kind of was a little different in their personalities. It's kind of referred to that why Ollie married her was because she had a pretty good dowry, which mm-hmm. is what the husband would get back in those days when a couple got married like this. So he was a playboy. He was constantly out with other women. He was carousing, and he didn't spend a lot of time at home. So that was kind of the start for, you know, how Fritz came into the world.
How did his mother treat Fritz? And tell us what she liked to do and have him do as a boy.
Well, you know, that was kind of because she was kind of stuck to her room a lot in her bedroom and didn't get out too much. She had him placed right in her bedroom with her, and she spent all of her time with him. And she was raising him as like a little girl. She dressed him in a lot of his sister's clothing. Taught him how to sew. He played with dolls. He was growing up very, very feminine, very much like a little girl had grown up. So she didn't really treat him like a boy. And then the father being away from home so much and not being interested in him or the kids, any of them, he didn't really learn how to do sports or anything sort of that a boy would be doing in those times. And it really hit him hard by the time he got into school, because when he got into school, of course, all the other boys would tease him and make fun of him because he was into dolls and a lot of girl things, and he didn't like sports, and he didn't like doing anything that the boys liked to do.
Mm-hmm. You say that he was apparently or supposedly molested by a teacher at 8 years old, but then you write that he became more physically fit and strong as a teenager. Regardless, he quit school at 15 years old and enrolled in the military in April 1895, you write. What was his military service like, and what happened in that 1895?
He kind of becomes stronger from being constantly picked on, and he became pretty athletic. He was pretty fit. And so when his father gave him permission to quit school at 15, he joined the military, and he jumped right in. Now, at the beginning, he was considered quite good. He wasn't a bad trainer or trainee, and he was doing quite well. But about five months or so into the service, he started having memory lapses and losing periods of time where he didn't know what happened. And there was a thought that he was passing out and having short, seizures of some sort.
Right.
And it wasn't until, I think, in the fall of that same year, 1895, while they were on an exercise, he actually collapsed. And so they took him to the military hospital, and they diagnosed him back then with an anxiety neurosis. So he sort of, they thought they could treat him, but their treatment and even their diagnosis was not really the best back then. They didn't really understand what was going on. They treated him for about 4 months, and really with no successful outcome or no cure. So he actually discharged himself. He walked away from the military, and they let him go. Not a problem. And that was because he just wasn't functioning, and they couldn't seem to get him back at or at the hospital. So they couldn't cure him in their mind.
Yeah, you write that he returns to Hanover, and a lot of this psychiatric evaluation, they use terms like irreversible brain damage, also having epilepsy or early dementia, or, as you write, it's known as schizophrenia. So it was all considered some form of mental illness, debilitating mental illness. So he was released. He got a pension, however, but he returned to Hanover and his dad's cigar factory. You write that as early as July 1896, he committed his first known of many sex offenses. What did all these sex offenses involve, and what were some of the characteristics of his M.O.?
Well, he would meet other boys, really around his age, maybe a little younger, maybe even a year or two older. He would become friends, and he would lure them back to a private place, and he would have sex with them. And a lot of cases, they said he was assaulting them. He was forcing them.
Right.
And so that was the first thing that he got arrested for, was with, I believe it was a 14-year-old. And so, yeah, so of course they sent him to be evaluated again. And again, he was diagnosed with an incurability deranged, and so they decided mm-hmm. he would be unfit to stand trial. So he never had to go to court and jail per se for something like that. And little things like this kept on happening. This went on for at least another year.
You say that he was ordered confined to the institution indefinitely, but however, 7 months later, what happens and where does he go?
Yeah, he was confined there, and it was kind of strange because his mother actually came and helped him break out, in essence.
Right.
And so he got away, and he ended up going to, I believe, Switzerland. I think he went right into Zurich, and he ended up staying with a friend of his mother's, like a really close friend, almost like an uncle. And so that's where he ended up, and that was by, I think, Christmas of 1897. which is it's kind of silly. But then he just started to work on the shipyards there, and he was a handyman, and he was fairly quiet, private. He never really got into trouble. He never got out into the society, into Zurich very much. He was a loner, and I think he was a little bit scared too as well by then.
Mm-hmm. In April 1899, he's back. He stays 16 months in Zurich before returning to Hanover, you write. And then in 1899, he becomes engaged to a woman named Erna Lowert, and she becomes pregnant shortly after. But you talk about October 1990, he gets a notification. What's this notification for, and where does he go?
Yeah, in the early 1900, France had become a threat to Germany, military. And so they ordered conscription. So they wanted all young men to go serve. And so he was served a letter. It was mandatory. You're in the military. So when he got that, he had to go serve his compulsory time, as they say. He left. He left his girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, with her soon-to-have child type thing, and father, and went to the military.
And what was his service this time characterized by? You say that he had a comment after this term of service. What was his experience like in the military this time?
Well, you know, that actually wasn't much different than the first one, in the sense that he was able to perform his duties. He started out doing a fairly good job. He had a fairly good record, just like in the first time when he was with the military. He didn't have any problems. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it was maybe a year into it. I believe, October of 01, that he found out that his mother died.
Right.
And he was very close to her. And he got into a terrible depression. And he was unable to do anything. They could hardly get him up. They could do anything. He wouldn't do anything. He wouldn't eat. Then he started coming back with the dizzy spells. And there was times where he said he couldn't see. He couldn't see what his eyes were all gone blurry. And again, during an exercise, same as the first time, he collapsed. And like the first time, he was sent to the hospital. And this time, the military had diagnosed him with unable to serve. It wasn't like he pulled himself out like in the first time.
Right.
This time they said, sorry, we're dismissing you. You cannot serve for us. And that's when he actually started getting his pension, and then returned back to the fiancé in Hanover and his father and that whole scenario. So he returned home and picked up where he left off.
Now, you talk about the relationship he has with his father after he comes back from the military. Tell us about these lawsuits and this discourse, or this disenchantment with each other, father and son.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His father didn't like him from the beginning. There was some sort of issue, and there's something behind this of his mother keeping him in the bedroom from the beginning, and they never really got along. But this time, now that he was older, stronger, and was had more courage, I guess, and wasn't as scared of his father, they started fighting. They would fight over all sorts of things, and it was so bad initially that the father decided to give his fiance a business, like it was a fishmongery. And
right.
He put it all in her name. He refused to put any of it in his own son's name. It's his money, which he got from Fritz's mother, and he gave it to the future, you know, daughter-in-law, to the fiance, and said, this is your business. So he would have to work there. That was a terrible, terrible insult. So they would fight. He would fight with his fiance. He would fight with his father. And he walked out on his father, because his father wanted him to keep working at his cigar shop, and he wouldn't. So the living situation was just awful, and they fought constantly. And eventually, Fritz would sue his own father You know, he would walk off the job, and he sued him. And I think that was, again, in fall of 1902. And he was saying that his father was making his workplace unbearable, and he couldn't work there because of his father. And he couldn't perform his job. And it was hard. And his father knew of his mental condition. So he really worked that. But he lost. That was a case that they didn't hear for very long. And they kind of, they were a little less caring in a way of people saying that they had mental illness. That was not considered a anything of sympathy back then, you know, even with psychologists, because, you know, that they called alienists and stuff, and they didn't really think of them as serious medicine here. Like, this isn't real condition. This is just all made up. So he ended up losing it, and he ended up coming back to the father and all that again, but then they got into a huge fight. He assaulted his father, and he threatened him, and it was terrible. The police had to come and take him away. He was placed in jail this time. But the father ended up working out a deal where he would drop the charges, but he wanted Fritz to see a proper psychologist. He needed help. And so this was ordered by the judge. And in the following year, 1903, he did see a doctor by the court, and he was ruled mentally unstable and morally inferior, whatever that means. With that in itself, but they didn't place him in an institute. They let him go. They said, "Well, yeah, you have these conditions, but we're not forcing you to get treatment for it." So he came back out, and there we go. He's back in the same situation again. And the two of them would continue fighting.
You talk about his fiance who was pregnant. She terminates their engagement. She's had enough. The fishmongery, like you say, the business was in her name. She told him to leave. And so you say for the next decade, Fritz Harman lives as a petty thief, burglar, and con artist. And in 1905 served several short jail terms sentences for larceny, embezzlement, and assault. And in 1913, arrested for a series of burglaries, sentenced to 5 years, and released in 1918 and went to Hanover. Tell us what happens in 1918 when he goes and rents his a single-room apartment.
Yeah, they let him out. He was getting out in that last year in the daytime because everyone had gone to the military with the upcoming and with the war and everything happening. And so they didn't have enough male workers in the cities. So from prison, he would be allowed to come out and work. And eventually he got out, and you're right. He got his own apartment. It's just a one-bedroom in the downtown. And it's really important to understand that Germany was in a terrible depression, you know, awful poverty.
Mm-hmm.
There was just no money, no jobs. A lot of people were just wandering, you know, place to place, looking for money or anything like that. And so what he would do was he went right back into the life of crime that he had left when he went into prison. He went right back into, you know, thieving and stealing and doing whatever he had to get by. And he had a good amount of experience. He was getting really good at stealing people's properties and getting what he needed to get food and to get his rent paid and stuff like that. He kind of rose to the top of the criminal breed on the streets, you might say. One of the biggest hangouts was, of course, the stations, the train station, like Hanover Station, where a lot of the homeless kids or kids were going station to station and hanging out, and they would get what they could for food. Some of them would. It was a really, really bad time for things like that. And so he started hanging out there, and he could work with some criminals and some others. He would offer them a place to stay, or he started getting really integrated. He was really in with that whole criminal, you know, kind of element back then, and he'd become very successful at this life of crime, and he started to make a good amount of money. And at the same time, you have to look at the, with all of the men gone to the war, like the police station in Hanover, I think they had 12 officers left to run the whole town, the whole city, all the crime. So they were really overrun. They were very short on support, and a lot of crimes they were just kind of letting go by, because they just didn't, they didn't have the time. They didn't have, a lot of these guys were working 6-7 days a week, and they could not keep up with it. So they were trying to keep the most popular, or the most popular, probably the most serious crimes in order. And eventually, Harmon worked his way in with the police, where he ended up being a kind of an informant. He became very close, and they would rely on anybody like that, because they needed all the help they could get.
Right. Now, in September 1918, Harmon, who's 39 years old at that time, he meets a young man at 17, Friedel Roth, in a coffee shop. And Roth is a runaway and needs a place to sleep. Tell us about what happens. He also introduces to Harmon his classmate, Fred. Tell us what happens here and how this leads to the meeting of Hans, his meeting with Hans Granz.
Yeah, that was his typical. He was meeting guys, and he would offer them a place to stay or food, and that's how he got with Roth. And then Roth himself and his friend, like Fred, you were saying, they would all sort of hang out, and he would end up having sex with them. That, you know, sex for food and for money and a place to stay and stuff like that. And that's kind of how, what the three of them had. But the main thing is that Fritz Harmon was really, he liked Roth, and that was sort of, so he was kind of trying to keep him around and be more of a, let's go for dinner, let's do something. And he tried to use him a little bit more. And Roth claimed, I guess at the time, and from what we hear, that he wasn't a homosexual, but he only did it for money and for food. He would only have sex with men, that is. So he wasn't really in that. And eventually, back at the apartment, Fritz's apartment, he had made advances to Rolf. He didn't want to do this, so he attacked him. He ended up killing him, raping him and killing him. And that was the very first time that we know, or there's any record of him actually biting the Adam's apple, biting that part of the neck while they're engaged in sex, and he would rip it off with his teeth. And this caused a lot of blood, and it also caused a kind of a paralyzation with the arms. So, that was kind of the story and how it came out as the Vampire of Hanover because of the blood and the neck. And that's kind of where one of his names that he was tagged with eventually came from, because he did this quite often with a lot of his victims.
Mm-hmm. You write that that he later says that this murder, or this, pardon me, this rape awakened a murderous urge in him never felt before. And he goes on, you get this information via him, that he was butchered and beheaded before breaking up the bones. And after he took several overnight trips to the cemetery over the next few weeks and put the body in a suitcase to be able to do that. But he kept some human remains behind the stove, you write, in the apartment. What happens with this Roth's friends? They report him missing. Tell us a little bit about their behavior and their initiative.
Yeah, when he went missing, he just didn't show up. He was no longer around. Of course, I believe they told his mother originally, and she went to the police, but nothing was really happening. The police, like I said, they were overrun. They had tons of runaway reports, people, you know, all over the streets. It was not a high priority, and they didn't have the resources to go looking for this runaway kid who was prostituting himself at the train station going missing, because there were several of them. There wasn't just one. So they didn't really pursue it very, very much. And so eventually the friends looked around and they tracked down Harmon and where he lived, and they knew it was him. And because they weren't, you know, there was nothing being done. So they went and pushed the police even harder. And they even got both of Roth's parents to come to the police station and also push this thing. And so it was just, it was a really tough go for them. This took a little while. And it was only after a fair bit of time, I think it was like October or something, it was like probably a good month later, that they finally decided they would go question Harmon at his apartment. You remember that they also considered Harmon to be an informer and someone that they kind of trusted and was kind of one of the boys, so to speak. You know, he was part of their team. So they weren't really looking to do, like, maybe they didn't believe it. The hard thing is they kind of knew he was a homosexual, which was a big deal then. That was like a crime. But they didn't want to believe it. But anyway, eventually two of the officers came, and when they went to the door and they got no answer, and they broke in through the door, and they found Harmon there with a young boy who was, I believe he was 13. And he was in bed with Harmon, who was naked, and the boy was almost naked. So they arrested him, and they charged him with the sexual assault of a minor. And he was taken to jail. And so that's how it happened with Roth. That's what came out of it. And when you mentioned the body part, he had cut up the body and disposed of everything except for the head. And he had that wrapped in a lot of newspaper and a little sack sort of thing that he had. And that was kind of in a cupboard where they normally kept wood and stuff that was behind the stove. So that was in the house. Now, they didn't have an arrest warrant. And again, they were sort of not really all that into searching the house or anything like that, because they still didn't believe that he killed anybody. He was just a homosexual. So he ended up serving, I believe, 9 months. I think he got a year or something, and he served 9 months in prison for that.
Yeah, you talk about during this time, though, he's trying to avoid that sentence. So by doing that, he's for a year, he's changing addresses. But during this time, you say this is when he met an 18-year-old man on the run that was living on the streets, selling clothing and things, Hans Granz. And apparently, Hans knew of Fritz Harmon. He knew who he was. Tell us a little bit more about this important meeting.
Yeah, a lot of the younger guys knew who Fritz was. Fritz was he had a little pass that he had from the police, and he was at the train stations all the time. And he would go waiting room to waiting room, and he would ask people for papers, and he was constantly involved with all the street kids and all the gangsters, and so to speak, and stuff. So, yeah, Hans knew who he was. Hans was a runaway, and he knew that the rumor was that he was a homosexual, and if you put out for him, you would get food or a place to stay. He would treat you really nice. Sometimes he'd give you money or whatever, stuff like that. So that was in Hans's mind when they first met. And that was kind of what Hans quite often declared, that he was not gay. He was a straight man, and he had several girlfriends. And this is true. He did have quite a string of girlfriends throughout the whole time. So that is believable. But he had no problem staying with Fritz and having sex with him and being part of the Fritz sort of thing. And with Fritz, he was immediately attracted to how Hans was a nice looking, well dressed, very, very handsome man. And he really was attracted to him, and, charming. He just had it all. So, it was kind of like the perfect combination at the time.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor, which is Quip. Good health starts with good habits. Quip makes it easy by delivering all the oral care essentials you'll need to care for your mouth. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million mouths and has timed sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses, a lightweight and sleek design, a multi-use travel cover, reusable handles in a range of sleek metal hues. On top of your brushing, you can upgrade your Quip with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing with the free Quip app, and earn amazing rewards like free refills, products, Target gift cards, and more. Beyond the brush, Quip has everything you need to build a complete routine. In addition to brush heads, Quip also delivers fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and gum refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of in-store shopping. With stylish and affordable electric brushes starting at just $25, you won't be paying through the teeth for better oral health. If you go to getquip.com/shocking right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/shocking. Spelled getquip.com/shocking. Quip, the good habits company. Now, Alan, we were just talking about this very fateful meeting of Hans Granz and Fritz Haarmann, and they both have a interest. They both have an interest in each other for different reasons. You write that in 1919 they moved into a house together. They only stayed about 6 months. They kept moving. But eventually they moved to an apartment near the Lien River. Tell us what happens at this apartment, and then there's another address as well. There's three addresses in total that are important. Tell us about some of their time behavior. What was it characterized by, and when does this partnership turn into something much different?
Well, it was kind of an interesting relationship because for Hans, it was just a one-night stand where he could get some money or food or something. He wasn't looking at it any more than that. But Fritz was totally, enamored with him. He's totally in love with him. So he eventually got him to come stay with him at first. And, they ended up having a lot of fights, a lot of arguments between the two. Hans was kind of on the lazy side. He wanted to sleep in. He just wanted to smoke, drink, hang out, and not really. He didn't really have any, any initiative or anything. So it's that sort of bothered Fritz. So they had a lot of fights over this sort of situation. Fritz was sometimes more violent. He would slap Hans. They would have a huge breakup. He would leave. And then Haarmann would go out and find him, apologize, and bring him back home. So they kind of had that type of relationship. It was up and down and happy and angry all at the same time. So when they moved into that apartment, I believe in December of 19, within 6 months, he had to serve that sentence for his assault of that 13-year-old boy just a few,
right.
Maybe it was 2 years earlier. So they actually sent him away. So he gave up the apartment, and then that's where he went to jail, and Hans had to go live at the train station again. When he got out in 1920, he went to a hotel, and then he went into this first apartment, which was really kind of a dark one room. It was like a basement floor apartment with it was just one room. Everything was all in one room. It wasn't, right. And that was at Neustrob. And so that's where they started getting back together again. And that's the two of them moved in, I believe, July of 21. And so that's kind of where it started from there. And that's where things started getting, you might say, to the dark side of what happened with the couple.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, that skulls are not, or skulls are found in 1924 by some young people, and they've determined that the ages of these people, 18 to 20, another skull is found. Tell us about the newspaper reports and these skulls being found and what it stirs up in Germany.
Yeah, it was pretty pretty scary for a lot of people. It was just a couple of kids that were hanging out. A lot of people hung along the river, and there was nothing to do, so they would hang out. And a skull washed up, and they told, I believe, the mother, who told the police. And then 2 weeks later, another skull came up. It started becoming a real panic in the area. So the police would end up eventually dragging the river, and where they would have, I believe it was well over 400 bones and body parts and stuff, you know, centered around that, skulls and things like that. So kind of a real fear started taking over the community, because like who was, like, what was all this? And so everyone got scared, and there was kind of this terror in the city, and that's kind of where it all started falling apart too.
Mm-hmm. You write about that. You say that Hans is a heterosexual, and as such, he has a girlfriend named Dorchen Maturgic, and she has a friend, and she's also, you write that she's a prostitute as well, and also cleans up, a housekeeper. But she has a friend named Ellie Schultz, and they are at the apartment of Fritz Harman. And Fritz Harman, there's another person that's a 17-year-old piano player, a young man. Tell us about this incredible scene that they find out much later, but you have via this information, this extraordinary, horrific scene.
Yeah, the 17-year-old, he was a piano player. I think he was from Berlin, about 17 at the time, and he was traveling around playing for, like, just money and food. He wasn't getting a whole lot of money, but he was surviving. And, of course, they spotted him, and the story's slightly different on each case, but basically they spot him, and they ended up partying with him, drinking, and bringing him back home. Now, the two girls and Hans Granz and Fritz were all back at the apartment, so with this piano player. And that's how it was when the ladies and Granz left. When they come back, they come back, and they were going to clean his apartment, because they cleaned every apartment in that building. He kept on telling them, well, you're going to have to come back later, I'm busy, and stuff like that. And so they didn't really know what was going on. And then, of course, Hans, when he came in, saw the 17-year-old laying in the bed, but at the time didn't know he was dead, or claimed he didn't know. And then later, the housekeepers come back, and they're cleaning, and of course they're very snoopy. And they ended up going through a cupboard and finding what they considered to be meat that had hair on it. And they believed it was part of the boy. And so they wrote a letter, and they actually went to the police, and they wrote an actual complaint to the police, saying that because he would give them meat sometimes in payment. He would give a lot of people meat. You know, meat was a really tough thing to come by at that time, and it was very expensive. And some people couldn't even get it. So this was a big deal. And I guess there was some hair on it. And then when they found that little part, they complained to the police that in their mind they thought that Fritz had killed this boy and cut him up and was using his meat to sell and give to people. Now, in this particular case, I don't think there's really any truth to it. And later when they tested it, it was, in fact, pork. It wasn't human.
Yeah.
So we know that the meat that the housekeepers had brought forward to say was human wasn't.
Right. You also write, though, that what would lead them to believe that possibly this would be meat, too, is the odd behavior when they came to clean. They said later in the afternoon when they came, the door was locked. You said, I'm busy, come back later. And then when they came in, the place was spotless, like it had been cleaned. And then he asked questions like, does it smell in here? So their suspicion was warranted, I would say, certainly so.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was suspicious behavior, for sure. But, you know, whether how far he would go with the meat and cutting and butchering and giving to them that it was human, or was he just having sex with the boys, because he was known as a homosexual, which they all knew. What made them jump to he's actually not only having sex with these boys, but he's killing them and then using their meat? I don't know what the jump was. I don't know what made them do that, because, you know, it's hard to say, you know, what their relationship was. So I don't know why they suspected that.
Yeah, well, he was a seller of contraband meat, you say. And then you say the contraband meat as well was boneless and diced, very much like ground meat. And so anybody reading that and anybody knowing that would be suspicious as well. Because you say some neighbors testified as well that it seemed like he left the home with big bags looking like it was meat packaged, but he didn't come into the home with very many parcels of meat packed. You know, so there was reports later, when I'm jumping ahead, but so let's talk about what leads to his arrest and then what happens.
Well, yeah, you know, that sort of lifestyle, he kept on doing this, even though at the time, and I tried to put that in here, how while things were going on, like they were finding a skull, then another pile of bones, and they were doing all of these things. And the terror was still kind of, you know, people were talking and it was becoming a fearful thing about all this. He continued to start picking and bringing boys home, and things kept on happening and they would go missing. And, you know, he continued doing this, having sex with young men and killing them, basically. He started quite often they would... not only were they suspected of taking the body for meat, but he would also take a lot of the clothing and he would use it and sell it and re-sew new buttons on it. And he would make slight changes to it. But if he wanted something that someone was wearing, he would take it for himself. Hans Grons was really big on this. And that seemed to be a lot of the reports tended to lead that Hans would see someone at a train station that was dressed really well in a suit, and he wanted that suit, and he would tell Fritz, oh, I want that. You've got to get that for me. And suggest to Fritz to take that boy home, kill him, so that he could get his suit or clothing or whatever he wanted. So that was behind a lot of this behavior as well. And so he continued to do this. And I've kind of gone through the 27 victims that he was convicted of or charged with killing. Mm-hmm. And there's also some other ones that suspected of, but there was no proof of it, or there wasn't enough to convict him or Hans. So that's kind of what the next group, and I did the best I could in finding out who the victim was, anything about their parents, their family, what they did, how they ended up on the street or how they ended up meeting him. And we put together the best that I could. It was a lot of research because a lot of these documents and a lot of the papers are all in German. And so I had to go through a whole translation period and go through everything. That took a really long time to get through. And it seems kind of light on some of the victims, but it's only because there was very little information on the victims. So that kept on going. He didn't seem to be he didn't seem to be in fear of being caught while he went through all this stuff. He just continued. Now,
Let's use an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Sorry, Alan, you were saying about this opportunity?
Oh, I was saying, he kept on doing it, and then it moved up, and then it wasn't until June of 24 that the kind of the beginning of the end started for him with the missing children and all of the things going on. So,
you write that when the police decide to arrest Harmon and bring him to the police station, several relatives of the missing boys and men waited outside the interview room. Tell us a little bit about this. This is another incredible scene.
Yeah, when they arrested him, they kind of paraded him through the street, and it was a big big deal. Like, everyone was just waiting for this to happen, so it was just crowded. And it's amazing because there was a lot of reports, and it was even brought to the court, and the judge had to give heck to some of the policemen because they apparently stripped him and they beat him, hung him, and caused a lot of damage to his body during the interrogations. And a lot of people listened to it outside the door. Some claim that they saw through the keyhole and stuff, and they saw that he had his pants down and that they were doing these things to him and trying to make him confess and stuff. And so that was a pretty big scandal at this time. Not so much like it would be today, because it wasn't unusual for the police to use physical means to try and get you, you know, slap you and punch you and stuff. That was not an unusual behavior for that time. But
right,
they seemed
right.
like they went much further than they expected. And it became a real frenzy. And, of course, everyone that was really upset about what he had done to all of these loved ones, all these kids, these boys, it caused a big controversy. And with that, when they raided his apartment, and a lot of the neighbors and people, they had 400 or 500 pieces of clothing and satchels and shoes and all sorts of things that they had confiscated, and they decided to put it all in a place. And anybody that had any young family member missing, they invited them to come down and see if they could identify any of the clothing or items that they found, books or papers or anything. And so they did. And that's sort of how they started putting together who it was that was murdered and who different things belonged to and who disappeared, and put together the story. And that's sort of why it was really difficult, because you have runaways with very little information out there, and living on the streets than going missing. And if their jacket and you know, bicycle showed up at their place, does that mean he killed them? And I think that was kind of the more than likely that he did. And so, but it wasn't easy for them to put this all together. And that's sort of how they did it.
You say he was arrested and charged for the 27 use and the crimes being committed between 1918 and 1924. And Hans Granz is charged as an accomplice as well. What is his behavior, Fritz Harman's behavior, regarding his guilt, and any kind of details regarding the murders themselves, and the difference with Hans Granz and his attitude towards his innocence?
Yeah, they were quite different people. There is no doubt. And Fritz, I don't know, he actually had no problem admitting. He seemed to be much more open about things. But he also cried a lot. He broke down a lot. He had to have his sister in with him during the detective interviews, and he had a lot of problems but and some suggest it was the sister that got him to do the confessions. But I don't think he had a huge problem admitting, but he wanted to make sure that they understood that he never premeditated anything, that it just happened, that his intention was never to murder anyone. He would have to, he would have them home, and then if they got into some sort of, sexual thing, something took over, and he couldn't stop from killing them, like biting their neck, you know, and doing the whole procedure. And then once he had that done, he had to get rid of the victim. And so he wanted people, he wanted the court to understand that. But he had no problem cutting up a body. But then he also said that he would be sick for 2 or 3 days after he cut up a body. Like it made him physically ill. So there seemed to be this thing about he wanted them to know that it caused a lot of stress and terror for him. It was not an easy thing, and he was as much a victim of some sort of possessing that made him do this. So that was kind of, and he wrote his confession that way, and I've included his confession. Now, Hans Gruns, of course, was more of the, I don't know how to describe him, but he wasn't taking responsibility for anything. He put everything on Fritz, and he had nothing to do with any of it. But during the trial, you heard a lot about these different cases. Fritz was pretty convincing at saying, well, I had nothing to do with that. I don't know anything about that. Or I don't know that person. I killed him because I was asked to. And it's kind of, as you go through each one and the victims, you start to realize that there was definitely a dichotomy here. There was something going on between these two that would create these murders. It was much more than we could see on the surface.
You write that he wasn't arrested right away, Hans, but Fritz said immediately that some of the murders were at the insistence of Hans. And so a week later, after Fritz was arrested and start talking, that Hans was arrested. Now, both of these people are set for trial, and you talk about the trial in December 1924, and Harmon insists on defending himself at this trial. Tell us a little bit more about this trial with Fritz, Harmon, and Hans Grant.
Yeah, you're right. And at the end of the day, Harmon admitted to killing 14 of the young men. And so that was kind of his kind of thing. And of course, the prosecution would show all of the evidence of the clothing that was found, and Fritz would come back and say, well, okay, maybe I did kill him. Like, it was so nonchalant. He didn't really, there were some victims he really recognized, and some that he would step up and say, yeah, I did this or did that, but others he wouldn't. And then he had no problem talking about how he would cut up the bodies, and how he would use a rolling pin or a potato masher. He would have descriptions and stuff. So he was intimately involved in it, but yet he wasn't premeditated, according to him. So it was kind of weird. And a lot of the people that were involved as well, like his landlady at the time and other people around him and stuff, It was pretty obvious what he was involved in. The worst thing was the two of them kind of trying to pin on who was responsible for the murder, you know. And if he didn't do a premeditated, which was kind of a counterproductive, because he says it was just an accident, an urge that took over, he was possessed. If Fritz, in fact, had said to him, oh, kill that guy or get that guy because I want his jacket, and then if he takes him home, he knows he's going to kill him. So that's premeditation. Right?
Sure.
It wasn't right. So that was a big, big problem with that case. And yeah, and he was not a lawyer. So I think that it was a mistake, but I don't know. Where do you go from there? It was bound to be convicted.
Yes, you're right. The incredible detail, and of course the gruesome, almost unparalleled crimes that this guy did at this time. He said, I had no intention of killing the young people. It happened. The boys kept coming back, and I wanted to protect them from myself. I knew when I had my tour again, something would happen. Just don't make me wild all the time. And so he talks about, I opened the abdominal cavity with two cuts and put the intestines in a bucket. Now I could grab the heart, lungs, kidneys, cut them up and put them in the bucket. Broke up the skull. Yeah. The brain went in the bucket and the chopped bones in the Lian River. It's unprecedented, the kinds of things he's testifying to in court.
What's the
public reaction, other than that the court is filled with people wanting to get in and hear the testimony? What's the public reaction at this time? And tell us what happens, the verdict.
Well, of course, there's every type of reaction. They're devastated. There's people that are upset and stressed, and people that are happy that he's done. It was just amazing. It was kind of the trial of the century, really. I guess we hear that a lot. But for that time period, it was amazing. And you got to remember, too, that most of these people had to be there and be around the court and in the streets in order to hear what was going on, because there was no other way. It's not like now you can just turn on the TV and watch the coverage. You know, it's quite a bit different, right? So that was it. Well, so he got convicted, of course, of all of, I believe, 27 of them. The Hans Grons got convicted of just, I believe, 6. It's been a while now. So it's he got convicted of just a few of them. But after this, a letter turned up that was apparently written by Fritz. And I believe it was, but it turned up, and it was basically, he was saying that Hans Grons had nothing to do with anything, that it was all him, and that he just said that he did because he was angry. And so Grons ended up getting a whole new trial, which would take place just over a year later. And he no longer was facing the death sentence with this. And he actually thought he was going to just get off scot-free. But he ended up getting sentenced to 2 12-year sentences to serve concurrently, which he served in prison. And then he got out, and he ended up in a concentration camp until the end of the war. And then he was released. He went back to Hanover, and he lived out his life there and died in 75, I believe.
Yeah. So the letter did really help, because he was slated for execution, so it really did work.
It saved his life.
Yeah. You write about a letter that after the execution, another letter surfaced. What was the content of that letter, essentially?
It was much the same sort of theme. I think that there was a real guilt that Harmon had, and you can sort of understand how their relationship was, and so it was kind of the same thing. But he sent that, I believe, was that letter was the one that went to Hans Grons' father, Albert. It was much the same. That's the most I can remember about it. He was really kind of trying to help Hans out.
You write that when he was asked how many victims he had, it was more than the 24 that he was convicted of, the 27. But how many did he say? What did he say regarding victims?
Well, there was one time he said 50, the other time it was 70. I don't think he really knows. To be honest, I think he just sort of did what he did, and he didn't keep track, because he didn't care about the victim themselves. It was about what he was getting out of it, right? And they kept his head too, right? After the conviction and execution, they kept his head in order to analyze it scientifically.
Right. And what was the reaction, or what did it create in Germany after this? As a result of this trial, what was the attitude towards homosexuality then?
Oh, it was hard. And I put that in there, and this is a very particular part of it, because at the beginning I talk about Germany in that time period and kind of a little bit about the government, the setting, how it was run, because it wasn't like it is now. And kind of the things that were going on with the gay community, so to speak, and how with the Sexual Institute in Germany, they were giving out day passes for trans people or people that were wearing opposite clothes for their sexuality and stuff, so that it wouldn't be arrested. And it was all sort of okay. And within 10 years of that, Berlin became kind of a big cabaret festive. There was like drag shows and all of these things going on. Everybody of any stature wanted to see these gay clubs and these gay shows. It was really trendy, and the police weren't arresting, and it was a totally different atmosphere going on with it. So when this happened, it jumped right back into the, well, he's a dirty homosexual, homosexuals kill people, they're bad. It sort of connected that. So there was a huge amount of controversy and talk and fighting over the forwarding of, you know, of homosexuals. A lot of people had the opinion that it's because we let them be free that they're killing and they're probably going to do all sorts of things. They need to be put away. They need to be arrested. So it kind of, there was a real backlash on the community that led right into the Nazism, which ended up kind of taking over Germany in the 30s. So it was just, it sort of fed right into the whole change in the atmosphere.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. I want to thank you very much, Alan, for coming on and talking about Butcher of Hanover, of Fritz Haarmann. For those people that might want to take a look at your several other books that you've written and your House of Mystery, tell us a little bit about House of Mystery radio program and where they might look at other books.
Well, my website, alanrwarren.com, has everything. It has the show. It has all the books. Any information, anything to do with me, all my social media. House of Mystery, we talk to writers in all sorts of genres, from true crime to fiction to everything. So it's kind of a, if you're a writer, you live in mystery. So that kind of follows that. So, you know, just go to that. And of course, you know, bookstores and Amazon carry all the books as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Alan R. Warren, Butcher of Hanover, Fritz Haarmann. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.